Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of the Morning Pulse, and I'm joined by George Grumbacher, who is the host of the Money Savage podcast. We're also joined by our correspondent on the Hill, Groom Law's Kevin Walsh. So, guys, good morning to you, or good afternoon, or depending on where you are.
Yeah, it is still morning here in Arizona, so good morning to you.
Yeah, it's so we're kind of here in D.C. Good morning, or good afternoon. Yeah,
and it's good afternoon. Good morning to you guys. Good afternoon from New York. And we're coast to coast, north, south, east, and west. And, guys, I just want to, before we kind of kick it off and kick it to Kevin, because we have some breaking news. You know, I have an upgrade. I actually went out and bought a headset, so I should feel less far away and less tinny, although I guess the debate will still rage.
It's like you're sitting in the room next to us.
I know. That's scary, isn't it?
Awesome.
Okay. Well, we've got Kevin Walsh from Groom Law. And Kevin, I know you've got some breaking news for us. I think this broke yesterday. But why don't you know, update us on the Fifth Circuit and what the ruling was that came down.
So, wow. We had a monumental decision yesterday in the Fifth Circuit. Chamber of Commerce versus the Department of Labor, the Fifth Circuit issued a decision yesterday evening vacating the 2016 fiduciary rule and related exemption packages in its entirety. So what this does is it kind of throws into the air the Department of Labor's efforts for the last 8-9 years now to rewrite and redefine fiduciary and investment advice.
Wow. So that's a really a reversal, as you said, from the Obama era rules. And, you know, I mean, I know you can't comment whether we're going back and forth, but it's, you know, backwards or forwards. But I mean, obviously this could potentially be a game changer in terms of how individuals and how firms are looking at this rule.
Yeah, this really represents a sea change in terms of what firms are going to expect going forward. In terms of kind of industry hopes, in terms of the hopes for what people were expecting, there was generally an expectation that the Department of Labor would make tweaks around the edges to the fiduciary rule to try to make it a little bit more workable for industry, and also so that it wouldn't lead to much of an increase in cost for consumers because of additional compliance costs for those financial institutions. What this does is having a circuit court come down and strike down the rule. Now, there still could be appeals, so it could come back. But if a circuit court kills the rule, it gives DOL a blank slate to start again from if it wants to do another fiduciary rule effort, or it could just let the old 1975 five-part test come back into effect. Wow. I can't possibly overstate the significance of this case.
Yeah, I mean, George, this is huge.
Yeah, and I know that just from personal experience, how many firms were scrambling over the foreseeable past to figure out how they were going to be able to handle 401k business, just retirement plan business in general, and that was a big shakeup for a lot of firms and a lot of individual advisors. So that's a real kind of a surprise, frankly.
It's been a big shakeup. I think there's still it's not as though this is, oh my gosh, the fiduciary rule's gone. We're going to have the Wild West here. You've still got a number of things on the horizon. So you have states that have become a lot more active in terms of crafting, enforcing, designing standards of care and standards of contact. You've got the NAIC and some insurance regulators who are working on new standards of care again for the distribution of insurance and annuity products. And you've had this SEC rule pending for a number of years now, and it sounds like they're trying to get it out sometime in the second quarter, which would, at a minimum, have some title reforms and could have some best interest standard implications of its own. So the fiduciary rule, and this is an overstatement because DOL could appeal, but it seems like we're heading for an environment where it's the fiduciary rule is dead. Long live whatever the new rules may be. And we could get new rules.
And I think, you know, George, thank you, Kevin. I think, George, Kevin, I mean, I think, you know, obviously we look to the regulators to regulate, but I think one of the things that we've talked about on this show before is the importance of individuals to do the prudent thing too. So you've got to continuously, you know, you can't just kind of set it and forget it. And this is more of a, you know, practical matter that you can't just set it and forget it and hope that everything's going to work out. I mean, you've got to be active in terms of looking at your retirement and planning. And that includes the evaluation of maybe not the investment decisions that are being made, but the evaluation of the people that are doing those, making those investment decisions on your behalf. So I think it just kind of underscores, okay, this change happened. We have to see how things kind of work out, right? But if I'm an individual investor and I have a financial advisor, I should be doing the prudent thing on a regular basis and evaluating the performance of that individual, what he or she is doing on my behalf, and making sure that, you know, they're acting in my best interest. So I have some complicity or activeness in terms of participating.
Matt, I think that's a great point.
And just go ahead, George. Sorry.
Yeah, I think that that's an excellent point. And the more people who can be mindful of making sure that they're putting out the best possible thing for the participants on the plan sponsor side, and then from a financial advisor side and the record keeper side, the better. Kevin, I'm curious, is there an explanation for why they decided to get rid of it?
So what's been going on for the last couple of years now is there was a legal challenge against the fiduciary rule brought by the Chamber of Commerce in the Northern District of Texas. At the district court level, the court ruled that the fiduciary rule was validly promulgated. So essentially that when DOL established this rule, created it, published the rule, they had ticked the boxes that a regulator needs to tick, and they had not exceeded their authority granted them by statute. Now, Chamber of Commerce appealed it, and the circuit court had a three-judge panel. They heard arguments in it last August, and they've been writing an opinion deciding that decision essentially from August until yesterday.
Wow.
And in the decision yesterday, they concluded for a number of reasons that DOL had exceeded its regulatory authority. Essentially, it was trying to, one of the examples is that in the IRA space, they had crafted the fiduciary rule in a way that captured behavior that wouldn't inherently be fiduciary, that one wouldn't consider to be fiduciary behavior. And their way of curing their overreach was that they granted this BIC exemption, the best interest contract exemption. Mm-hmm. But essentially, it boils down to a kind of some technical terms. There's this theory of deference, Chevron deference. For an agency to validly promulgate a rule, there has to be some ambiguity that was delegated to the agency to figure out what to do in that ambiguous area. And then what the agency does has to make sense in that area. So it's got to be essentially reasonable. And the Fifth Circuit said the language that DOL is regulating isn't ambiguous. And even if it was ambiguous, what they're doing isn't reasonable. So huge decision, completely unwrites that 2016 package. Now, DOL can appeal, but this is a big deal.
It's a very big deal, and I have to assume that they will appeal. Is that fair to say?
I think it would be a safe assumption. Had Hillary Clinton won or had Obama had a third term, that DOL would appeal. Now, the people who wrote the rule, the political individuals who signed off on the deal during the Obama administration have been replaced by Trump appointees. So there is a chance that Trump appointees would go in a different direction. So while there is some likelihood they'll appeal, this could provide those Trump appointees with an opportunity to walk away from the rule without having to go through complicated rulemaking.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. I know you have a lot to get back to in terms of dealing with all this, I guess, fallout, for lack of a better term. So we thank you, and we look forward to catching up with you again. Maybe you'll have some more updates next week or in a future episode. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It was great talking to you. Talk to you next week.
Thanks. Thank you. That was Groom Law's Kevin Walsh. Well, special thanks to Kevin Walsh of Groom Law for kind of breaking down the Fifth Circuit. And now we're going to turn our attention to the financial markets, and we're joined by Invesco Chief Global Market Strategist, Ms. Christina Hooper. Christina, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, it's been a couple months since you and I caught up over on the Morning Pulse, and George and I kind of started this podcast a couple weeks ago, and, we're really excited to bring in financial and market experts like yourself. So, want to get your assessment, just a high-level assessment of kind of what's occurred to date and what's occurred this week. Maybe that, our listeners who are both institutional and individual would probably find your assessment very interesting.
Well, we had more of the same. We saw the same kind of tug of war that we've seen in the last few weeks in terms of concerns about protectionism leading to trade wars. We also saw, interestingly, some abatement in signs of inflation. And so one pressure on markets, the idea that the Fed would get more aggressive, took a breather this week just because we got pretty modest readings on inflation. And so all in all, it was a week where we saw fluctuations. And again, this is very much a part of what we're seeing in 2018. It's a new kind of environment. It really was kicked off with the January jobs report release, where we saw a much higher average hourly earnings number that kicked the stock market into a heightened sense of nervousness. And that continues. So we certainly go through bursts of positive fervor, and we saw that this week as well. But it's also been tamped down by concerns about a more hawkish Fed at times, as well as concerns about protectionism, which seems to be the key risk on the minds of market participants.
Protectionism is the key risk. Interesting. I'm always curious, and unfortunately, I don't know historically how presidential behaviors affect the market. But in today's social media world, where information is flying around so quickly and so much, how much are presidential scandals, how much does that actually impact the market?
I think the market has become completely immune to presidential scandals, to the turmoil that's going on in the White House. This is a stock market that has blinders on and is looking forward, with the exception of risk around protectionism. That's that one area that I think actually does matter to economic growth, and it matters to markets. But excluding that, I think that the market is just focused more on the bigger picture, and certainly on the Fed, which of course we have meeting next week, and it's an all-new Fed.
Got it. And just to sort of round that out, recently China announced that they were not going to have term limits. So do you think that that's going to have a negative or positive impact on the markets?
I'm confident that is not going to have much of an impact at all, with the exception of how it relates to protectionism.
Right.
Because now what you have is a president in China who has a much stronger hand. Mm-hmm. So he has the ability to react to the imposition of tariffs in a stronger way, in my view.
Got it.
Shifting gears a little bit, Christina, we were just talking to Kevin Walsh, and I think, I like the line of thinking that George was going down. So we just talked to Kevin Walsh of Groom Law about the Fifth Circuit ruling on the fiduciary rule. So basically, I don't know if striking it down is the right word, but definitely putting the ruling and the implementation in flux. How much does the market factor that in? I mean, is that on an equal footing to the Trump tariffs or some other events, or does that kind of just okay, that's not a big deal, and let's keep moving?
What I've seen is that it is a non-event for markets, and I would expect that to be the case. Keep in mind that this is occurring in the context of a significant move towards deregulation, and so that positive climate doesn't change with this one ruling, which just adds a level of uncertainty, but arguably, ultimately, will add more to deregulation.
Got it. Go ahead, Jeff.
Go ahead, George. I was going to let me just interrupt one thing I was thinking about, and I don't want to get off the topic you had, but just a couple months ago, we were talking about the irrational exuberance of participants, individuals who saw their 401k balances jump. They were bragging about them on social media. Now we've got the volatility. And if I'm a participant, I'm seeing this whipsaw, this up and down, this volatility. There's got to be some trepidation in the mind of the average investor, George. And I'm just wondering, between, Christina, I know you're more institutional focus, but if you're an average investor, you're still looking at the long term, right? I mean, you're still got to think about this, 5, 10, 15, 20 years towards your retirement.
Well, we have to constantly remind participants about keeping an eye on the longer term and really focusing on the longer term, because this is the kind of environment that can pull participants away from their objectives and away from a long-term focus, because it does become disturbing. So far, I don't believe it has had any kind of significant impact, because plan participants are experiencing upside as well as downside, even though there has been a much more heightened level of volatility. And so it can continue like this for a while. It's when we see a very significant correction, and I don't think we really experience that because the market bounced back so quickly. But when we do experience that, that's the time to really reiterate that message about having a long-term perspective.
Got it.
Sorry, George. I didn't mean to step on you, bud.
No problem. What is the worst case scenario of protectionism by the market when, say, theoretically speaking, President Trump really circles the wagons here and the president of China circles the wagons there? What happens to the market?
So the worst case scenario, from my perspective, is one that perhaps the market hasn't fully contemplated, and that's that the U.S. applies significant tariffs to Chinese goods, and China retaliates not by applying tariffs to U.S. goods, but by making the decision to not purchase U.S. treasuries or to sell some of the U.S. treasuries it holds. And that, to me, is the greatest risk, because that jacks up U.S. borrowing costs, all else being equal.
Got it. Unintended consequences.
There's a lot of that that goes on. There's a lot of that that goes on. I think that's, you know, to the point of that Christina made earlier, this administration's really tried to roll back some of those regulations because, and that, you know, that has a lot of unintended consequences, the compliance costs, the additional costs that get passed through to customers. So, you know, there's a lot of that that I think gets factored into the market.
Well, Christina, that was awesome stuff. We thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you, Christina Hooper. Thank you so much. So that was a great conversation with Chief Global Market Strategist Christina Hooper from Invesco. And now we're joined by lead anchor from TD Ameritrade Network, Morning Trade Live, and Market on the Close, Mr. Oliver Rennick. Welcome back to the show, Oliver.
Hey, what's up, guys? Glad to join you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, hope you had a great week. Hope you had a great Friday. You're having a great Friday.
Hey, it's quiet in markets, and I'm ready to have a good little St. Paddy's here in Chicago. So no complaints with low volatility.
There you go. So
do they still dye the Chicago River green, or have environmentalists
they do.
Put the kibosh on that?
No, I think they do, and I think every year it gets a little bit less of a challenge. Like, I think the difference between the dyed green and the regular is shrinking every year. But
nice. By the way, how's your 40-yard dash?
You know, I haven't been practicing it, but I know I got to get around to it given the expectations I put up on the board last time.
It's not going to get better on its own.
You know, Kelly's going to challenge you that when he gets back into on the show.
He is. You know, I thought I had some good market commentary, but that seemed to be the part that he really stuck onto.
he did. I think the social media audience wants to see you guys compete. We'll do like our own little NFL combine.
We'll call it
the Weekly Pulse Combine. So, you know, obviously you are, as the anchor for the Markets on the Close and Morning Trade Live, you are following the markets in detail. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind, we just had Christina Hooper on from Invesco, and she gave us her assessment of the Trump tariffs. But, you know, you're out there following these things on a regular basis. What's your assessment of the week, and what should investors take away from what's happened?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I mean, in many ways, I think Christina's very right to continue thinking about things like tariffs and geopolitics. It's interesting because earlier in the week, there were signs that maybe that was still lingering in investors' minds. We had some weakness in industrial names that typically kind of moved. I shouldn't say typically, but really in the small sample set we've had since that, I guess, three Thursdays ago now, where we first brought up this idea of tariffs, we kind of saw the way this might play out in markets, and it's industrial companies weaker. The exporters who will also be consuming, at least at the time it was about steel and aluminum, but then it's just kind of a general risk if they're exposed internationally, and strength within some of the domestic small caps, the Russell 2000, which had really gotten a slow start to the year. You kind of saw that similar divergence at the start of this week when we saw small caps doing pretty decently on Monday, but overall, this market has kind of progressively just ebbed lower. and that came right after the heels of a big pop in the NASDAQ back to highs. So we continue to kind of see this market that seems to be digesting a lot of that kind of geopolitical risk. But at the same time, there's plenty of earnings here. There's plenty of stock-specific stories, and there's a lot of churn. I'd call it maybe micro-churn as investors trying to figure out what to do after that weakness we saw at the start of the year.
Got it. Interesting. Well, I saw that that Angela Merkel was going to be meeting with the French President Macron today or tomorrow to be talking about the impact that protectionism or the tariffs would have on their countries, and it seems like that would have a pretty large impact on France and Germany. So be interested to see what happens.
It's interesting because the whole sort of – there's basically two parts of the tariff trade, at least as equity markets are concerned, and that's where I focus mostly on, is the micro stories for companies that would actually be exposed to the specific commodities or the specific materials that are affected by any given tariff. And then there's also a general risk on and risk off kind of mentality that comes about when we start talking about that geopolitical risk. When the market – sold off at the first proposal of steel and aluminum, it was largely because of suspicions that this would then boil over into a quote-unquote trade war that goes far beyond, say, steel or aluminum or whatever it may be. And then, as many expected, there were exemptions from our closest allies, Canada, Mexico. There were exemptions kind of put on the table for anyone who wants to basically write in and say, hey, here's why I shouldn't be involved in this. So as that kind of faded, the market came back, but depending on what comes next and if there is more protectionism down the road, then you might have a reason for why there's some hesitation really to get exposed to some of those big industrial companies.
You know, I think we've talked about this probably ad nauseum for the audience, but I'm just going to bring it up because that's what I do. We just talked about the 40-yard dash, but if I'm an institutional investor, okay, public pension, a foundation, an endowment, let's put aside the individual investors because they should always be thinking long term. But these folks have to recalibrate their portfolios, and I'm sure, they're kind of scratching their heads. If you're a CIO of a major endowment, where do I? Because they typically rebalance on a monthly basis. You know, where do I start allocating my money? I think that's got all these market events. Not that they haven't been so complicated in the past, but I got to think that this kind of throws people for a loop, I would imagine.
It does, and it's challenging for a lot of reasons because they already were, if you're a pension fund manager or an endowment manager or whatever it may be, and you kind of have that long-term goal to generate a certain year-on-year return, 6-7%, whatever it may be, while you've been able to count on that in the equity market, they've been already having to deal with a sort of cross-asset class rotation, which is spurred by a rising interest rate environment, speculation about what that means for companies that have been very reliable winners. Will those still be the winners in a rising rate environment? There's a whole debate about that. And then on top of that, then you mix in a risk that is more top-down that becomes this geopolitical risk, which is perhaps something that could then bring risk out of the market and put strength into something like bonds and move yields down when we were just sitting here talking about a conversation that was supposed to be certain with bond yields higher and rising rates. So, you're absolutely right. I think it probably makes it more challenging. And, as you mentioned, it's not just for those. It's for everybody. But if you have a requirement to, meet a certain return, then there's a lot of things you got to weigh right now.
George, obviously, we've been talking about institutional investors, obviously the 401k participants, all these big economic issues, challenges, they're probably looking at the market, calling the help center. We just talked to Christina about this. They've got to have maintain this long-term view. So whether they're invested in a managed account, a target date fund, or something that they've kind of set on their own asset allocation, either by themselves or an advisor, I got to think that, holding steady and weighing handling these up and downs of the market over a short period of time is the way to go.
Dealing with the psychological challenges that a volatile market presents is always going to be one of the toughest things, and frankly the reason that the average investor gets, I think, around a 3% less than the actual market returns. So always keeping in mind that you have a long time, probably 10, 20, yeah. 30 years to be invested in the market. And while it's interesting and can make you nervous when you see big swings, you just need to tough it out and stay in. So,
okay, Oliver, one last question. Next week, what's on tap on TD Ameritrade Network, and what things are you thinking about with your audience in terms of what you're going to be covering? What's top of mind?
You know, the easy one that I think everybody's obviously talking about is, of course, we're going to hear from Jay Powell from the Fed. But within that, you also have a pretty busy slate. I'm actually really interested in housing because we're going to get some information from that sector in terms of new home sales and then existing home sales later on in the week. You've got durable goods also from an economic standpoint. But housing for me is really interesting, as many see that sort of as a leading indicator for the economy. Obviously, we sort of still have battle scars from the signs that they gave us housing prices in 2006, 2007. And even within this kind of sluggish economy, there's been a big, up until probably about a year ago or so, many described as this kind of slow grinding economy. Housing prices were already climbing. Housing prices were getting higher. We all know how expensive it is to live in San Francisco or New York, and then that started to permeate the rest of the country. So whether or not this kind of slowdown we're seeing in that is because of a supply coming back into the market, as there was very much a dearth in supply, or if it is a lessening demand. I mean, it's going to be really important, I think. And for the equity market, it's important for one of the biggest groups of companies that were reliable winners for a long time, the home builders, the home renovators, Home Depot, Lowe's, those types of companies, because that comes back to right where we started, which is about rotational shifts. You know, investment managers and pension fund managers and anyone with exposure to equities is trying to figure out what will be the winner in this stage of whatever stage we are, you know, in this economic cycle. So I got my eyes on a lot. Everybody's going to be watching Powell, but, you know, I'll go with housing. I'll go with housing.
All right. Well,
there's the hot take. I like it.
Yeah. Well, Oliver, thank you so much. And if people can certainly check you out on the TD Ameritrade Network. And you have you have two shows, one in the morning, Markets on the Morning Trade Live, and Markets on the Close, where you wrap up the markets every day.
You got it. I appreciate it, guys. Always fun chatting
Thanks.
With you.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Have a good one, Jeff. Have a good one.
Special thanks to Oliver Renick for joining us on the show and sharing his insight into what's going on in the markets. And now we're going to shift discussions and conversations, George, to our friend Elizabeth Beth Bell from Senator Ben Cardin's office. Beth, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I guess before we begin, I just want to preface our conversation that the words and conversation that we're going to have is really your opinion and not the opinion of Senator Cardin or Senator Cardin's office. So I wanted to get that out there for our audience. It's a complete disclaimer. And we're happy to have you back on the show, or have you on our show, and also have you share your insight into what's going on in Capitol Hill. So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me back.
Hey, so Beth, there's a lot going on with the fiduciary rule, and I think that I just read that New York State they've now passed a retirement plan, kind of like Oregon put in place for really small businesses that aren't able to offer retirement plans. And I saw that Senator Cardin is now the ranking member of the Small Business Committee. And I was curious what it is that they're going to be working on, or what they're really going to be focused on.
Yes. As you note, there is a lot of stuff going on that just came out very recently. You heard about the oil pool tonight, I believe. So I think that the folks in the Senate are going to need time to process that. We have been keeping our eye on the retirement plans that are being set up on the state level. As you might know, we have legislation in Maryland in that regard. And you're absolutely correct that all of these items intersect with Senator Cardin's new role as ranking member on small business. In fact, I have been relocated over to that office and am calling you from the committee offices because Senator Cardin plans to make retirement for small businesses a big part of his focus in that role. I think the agenda is still shaping up, to be honest with you. The good news is, unlike other issues in this Congress, especially for this election, retirement still remains, both retirement and small business, still remains pretty bipartisan. So we're looking forward to working with Chairman Risch's staff on that, and also to continue working with our Republican Democratic partners in Congress on specifics. I mean, like I said, it's still being formulated, but we have a lot of interest in kind of tackling more low-hanging fruit provisions like the Senate did with the Retirement Enhancement Savings Act, looking at broader changes to help nudge the coverage needle. Again, I think unlike some other issues, we can do a lot of things to get these conversations going in a bipartisan way.
Well, it's good that we can agree that everyone is going to have to retire, whether Republican or Democrat, left or right, and everybody, all of us on this call and across the country are going to have to retire. So I'm glad we can at least agree on that, because there's a lot of sniping going on, unfortunately, that we'll stay out of course, because we are independent and bipartisan on this show. You know, you talk about small business coverage. We had Lisa Messina on last week, and she's Oregon's executive director for the new Oregon Auto IRA program. And, you know, I think your boss, Senator Cardin, has been a long-term advocate for retirement security. I know that he has helped pass bills on behalf of NAGDA for America Saves Week. And, you know, he has been an advocate for American retirement for such a long time. So we thank him for his and your participation in that regard.
Of course, it's the right thing to do, and we're more than happy to do it.
When we last spoke, and I think this was back in the fall, we were talking about tax reform. And ultimately, we got some form of tax reform that became effective in 2018. Read recently that there may be aspects of the bill, and I know that, you know, not necessarily tied to the Senate Finance Committee, but any inkling of whether this has any legs? Because this is an election year, so typically in talking with our friend Kevin Walsh from Groom Law, you know, that typically not a lot is passed during an election year. We have a third of the Senate up and all the House up. But anything in terms of additional tax reform or thoughts about tax reform that at least being talked about within the halls of the Senate or the Congress?
This is an interesting question. I think it would be fair to say that it is being talked about. I think Kevin is right that it may not be an issue that we get to tackle until the end of the year at the earliest. Now, there may be some kind of small provisions that have bipartisan consensus or have consensus on one side or the other that are considered urgent enough issues that they get taken up sooner. For instance, I would flag the pass-through deductions for farming co-ops. That's been in the news a lot. That is something that has been in play with our omnibus. You do see these tax items being raised. I think the main issue that the Congress faces right now is that, you know, we need to prioritize these decisions, and we need to get Republicans and Democrats to come together on them. And I think that will be a longer term effort, just because of the nature of how the tax bill debate played out, and how exactly we're going to process these changes. I think folks come at it very differently from the Republican and Democratic sides, it's fair to say. So I think, again, I'll circle back. I just haven't been absolutely right, that it's most likely a year-end effort. I think Democrats have a lot of requests in this regard in terms of provisions that may be outside of the tax bill that they could include in any package that fixed things in the tax bill. So that will continue to be a robust behind-the-scenes debate, I suspect. In terms of, you know, retirement issues in general, I think that's a question, like I said at the top, it's still ongoing and will remain squarely. We're looking forward to continuing those conversations.
Nice. Do you get the sense that the federal government is content with letting states make their own decisions on these retirement plans, like Oregon Saves, for example?
You know, this is an interesting question too. I feel like I'm being very unhelpful to your audience. I say, yeah, I'm not sure. Well, first of all, I'm not sure of the openness to continuing to develop those plans. I know that there's a lot of support in in Congress among some members, especially four states to act on that. And I think there's, but I should note that there's also this overlay in Congress where, you know, we think as the on the federal level, there could be a productive role, not only to help the states, but also perhaps to set some best practices too, so that, you know, plan providers and participants, to the extent they move across states, may not have to deal with patchwork. It's also that theme going through that debate. But, you know, putting that aside, moving the coverage needle, I think, is something that has the broad swath agreement, really how that is implemented, that will be discussed. And I imagine, even though I can't speak for them again, that is being discussed in the corridors of the DOL and the administration, other administration offices as well.
Got it. Well, it's exciting that action is being taken, and, you know, we'll see what the final product actually looks like, but that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think, and Beth, just for whatever it's worth, I think George and I would both agree that we would love the Weekly Pulse Sunday to be the starting point for a national movement on retirement. So you and your colleagues can feel very comfortable coming on and sharing any insight related to retirement and financial preparedness. We want this to be that type of forum, unbiased but unafraid to tackle the tough issues. Right, George? So we want to invite you to certainly come back and have your colleagues come back, and we can kind of keep the dialogue going and hopefully make this a sexy national issue.
Exactly.
I love the idea of putting retirement on the top of everyone's agenda. I think Senator Cardin would really like that too. It's super important to us. And yes, I'm sure my colleagues and I would be happy to join in on that discussion.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Beth.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So a special thanks to Beth Bell from Senator Ben Cardin's office. It was a great conversation. We look forward to having her and her colleagues back on the show to talk about retirement legislation and what's going on in Washington, D.C. Joining us now is the founder and CEO of 401kplans.com, Mr. Scott Buffington. Scott, thanks for joining George and I on the Weekly Pulse Sunday today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I think this is really exciting, George. What Scott is doing, and, you know, you and I love fintech, and what Scott is doing is really groundbreaking.
What are you doing, Scott?
Nice. Right, take it right to the point. What are you doing, Scott?
Exactly. Well, thank you for that intro and teeing it up. But what I've built is 401kplans.com. So it is a mobile app or a digital distribution platform that allows intermediaries, so a consultant or a financial advisor, to be able to complete a full due diligence process on a retirement plan. And instead of spending many, many hours and a lot of manual work and spreadsheets and issuing proposals, to do it in about 3 minutes on an app. So as you probably know, most voluntary benefits you can purchase on an exchange, or there's other digital distribution platforms. And I'd say 401ks is way behind the times to leverage technology to enhance distribution and make the process more efficient, and then allow everybody to mitigate risk and comply with their new fiduciary responsibilities.
Right. And I think George and Scott, I think there's no market that is really underserved in this regard than the smaller retirement plan marketplace. Scott, would you agree with that? And, can you talk about the genesis of your idea? Because I know you've had a really rich background in serving various constituencies within the retirement marketplace.
That's right. I've been in the business for a little over 25 years, and my background was always mid to large market retirement plans. And through a previous employer, we made an acquisition and became a very large player in the small plan market. And what you really find when you compare the two is the vast differences in knowledge and expertise, certainly supporting a small business owner, providing the guidance on the retirement plan. It's just as important to have a viable retirement plan for a small business employee as a large, but they certainly can't afford an institutional consultant that's going to teach them about the funds and their proper due diligence. And And what you find is they would typically work with a financial advisor, and that financial advisor may be someone who they work with on their with their personal assets. And that financial advisor will be responsible for doing the complete due diligence on a retirement plan and monitoring the funds, educating the participants. The only issue that you find is most of those advisors are really experts in the personal side and are not experts on the 401k or retirement side. So this app really supports that generalist financial advisor and has a repeatable, consistent process that they can follow, a prudent process that they can follow. It can incorporate the investment due diligence and really just streamlines that whole fiduciary process, which will protect that financial advisor, it will protect that broker-dealer, and then it certainly protects the beneficiaries, which is obviously the plan sponsor and the participants, to make sure they have the right service providers, offer the right funds, and that fees are all in a reasonable range.
Got it. Well, that's a really, really powerful tool. So essentially, with what just happened with the fiduciary rule being vacated, which we were talking about a little bit earlier, and then it's such, I don't want to call it a burden, but it's so much to ask a small company to do everything that they're already doing, to keep the lights on and keep payroll going, to offer health insurance, but then you also have to be an expert in making sure that you're monitoring and doing a good job with the 401k too, and this is addressing that problem, which is such a powerful thing. Awesome. Got it.
Yeah, Scott, you know, our industry, I think I'll speak for George, even though I don't normally do that. He speaks for me. You know, our industry does not move very quickly in terms of technological innovation. And oftentimes, you know, there's some institutional biases that exist or there's incremental change. You know, I think what we're trying to do on this show is really educate people. But when you were building 401kplans.com, how did you handle the duration, the time it takes for change to happen, and how did you weigh that? I think the audience would be not only interested in the product and what you're created, the service you created, but the formulation of it and weighing the movement of the industry in terms of evolving.
Yeah, and I'd say it's still evolving. I mean, this industry does move very slow, and I would say specifically with 401ks. The way of doing business, the way of doing distribution, it really hasn't changed in quite a while, and people are afraid of that change. So I would say from the formation of the idea to starting to develop the technology, my assumption was it would be slow, but might move a little faster than it actually has. And people are just certainly afraid of change. But what we have right now is with the fiduciary rule in flux, and certainly was introduced, and then parts of it are being delayed, and now we have the new ruling today. That's creating a little chaos in our industry, and it's creating chaos with broker-dealers. It creates chaos with the business models of 401k providers. And without some clarity, I think the chaos will certainly continue. There's a lot of firms, there's a lot of product development that is going on in our industry to try to fill that hole from the fiduciary rule or fit a need. But as that puck keeps moving and the rule keeps changing, it's difficult to implement some of these solutions that are being proposed to have a solution for these broker-dealers to offer to their financial advisors, which are then offered to their small business owners. So there is a lot of flux, and I think some of the delay in adopting change has to do with kind of the chaos in our industry with the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule.
Thanks, Scott. We've been talking a lot about 401ks. Any thoughts about expanding to other segments of the market? So, you know, 403b, there's a lot of opportunity there in terms of multi-vendor, lots of maybe higher fees, higher cost investments, and then the public or governmental segment. I mean, I know the company is called 401kplans.com, but could your service apply to these other markets as well?
It absolutely can, and that is the long-term goal, is that we start in the small plan 401k space where there's the largest need. We can certainly go up market within the 401k space, but then work with different providers of 403Bs or in the nonprofit or municipal markets and be able to offer a solution that's appropriate for them as well. That's something that technology can absolutely handle as we grow and add resources to the firm.
That's exciting. So the perfect user for this service is a company that maybe they obviously are offering a retirement plan, a 401k, and maybe they have a financial advisor, maybe they don't, but they just want to make sure that they are crossing their T's and dotting their I's and making sure that they are performing their fiduciary duties. Is that right?
Yeah, the user of the tool is a financial intermediary who has some basic knowledge of 401k plans. Ideally, they would use it if they're looking for a new vendor. They would look. They would use it for regular benchmarking or due diligence, and create a documented, repeatable process that they can keep in a fiduciary file for their client. So that's ideally how it could be used, and it will be available on Android as well as iOS. So a financial advisor, really on their smartphone, could take about 10 hours of work, whittle it down to about 3 minutes in that documented, repeatable process. So really, just let's try to take that off the table, since it's not being done consistently today, and it's something that is required. I mean, it's an obligation of a fiduciary for it to be done. So hopefully this makes the process that much more efficient for somebody who knows what they're doing, or not, but certainly mitigates risk for that person who really isn't a retirement expert but servicing a retirement plan.
Well, if you're able to take 10 hours of work and boil it down to 3 minutes in other areas, I would be interested in learning more about that too. So that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back. Not only talk about 401kplans.com, but if you could also kind of serve as a correspondent, if you will, on the fintech industry. I think our audience would love to hear about some of these newer innovations that are coming down the pike. And I think, as someone who has founded and built a company from the ground up and has an interesting perspective, you could be able to shed some light on that subject for us.
That sounds great. I'd love to do it.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you so much for joining us, Scott.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Take care.
Well, George, that's our show. I mean, you tick off who we went through. We had Kevin Walsh from Groom Law talk about this Fifth Circuit Court ruling. We had Christina Hooper talk about tariffs and market conditions. Oliver Rennick from TD Ameritrade talking about what he's seeing in his shows, markets volatility, the real estate bubble. We had Beth Bell from Senator Cardin's office. And we just got off the phone with Scott Buffington from 401kplans.com. What more can you do?
Those are strong, strong guests right there, sir. And the technology was a little bit better, so I'm getting better at my job. So things are looking up all over the place, man.
I agree. I'm so happy that people can actually hear me and I don't sound tinny. And next week we've got some even more great guests. We've got Julie Canner from Two Mentors. So she really specializes in mentoring. And talking about mentoring, and I think some of what she learned will really apply to the 401k and retirement industry, both for advisors and people looking to move up in their organizations, but also for participants looking to save and plan. And we also have Daniel Alexander, who's going to be who's the CEO of Principal Review, and they're a brand new cutting edge technology service to kind of look at direct and indirect compensation of financial advisors. So I think this is really shaping up to be a good show. And next week's going to be another test of that.
That sounds like a great lineup next week as well. So I totally agree and looking forward to that. So well done, sir, and you have a good weekend.
You too. Enjoy your time with your family, and we'll catch up next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, bud.